Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For decades, tribal nations and salmon advocates have been working every avenue to take down the forest dams on the Lower Snake River. These dams provide a modicum of electricity, minimal shipping passage, and some irrigation water for farmers. But mostly they kill salmon. Yet after decades of inaction, there is finally real momentum and cause for hope. Today we talk with Kate Murphy, Columbia Riverkeeper Community Organizer, and Kaylani Scott, Communications Manager for the Nez Perce Tribe, about the plans that Washington Governor Jay Inslee and Senator Patty Murray will release this summer for replacing the services provided by the Snake River dams so they can finally be breached. Kate and Kaylani, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on, Kaylani, and you too, Kate.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
It's been a long time coming, I think, that there's a serious discussion about taking these dams down. It seems like so many times we've heard proposals that the only way for the salmon to recover along the Snake River and the Columbia River is for the dams to come down. So what has changed in the last few months that gives us more hope? And I'll start with you, Kate.
Thanks, Barbara. Yeah, there's a lot that's been evolving in this movement. And I'd like to start by thanking Kaylani for being here today. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge the tribal leadership in this campaign. The Nez Perce tribe has been and continues to be an incredible leader in bringing attention to the health of the salmon and the need to restore this region and remove the Lower Snake River dams. Roughly 60 tribes in the Pacific Northwest have called for Snake River dam removal. And myself and my colleagues at Columbia Riverkeeper are honored to stand in solidarity with the tribes and follow their lead on what is best for the salmon. And I also just kind of, before we dig in to all the things that have been happening, I'd love to just set the stage a little bit for to talk about what we're fighting to protect. So the Pacific Northwest salmon are a keystone species. And what that means is that they're critically important to our ecosystem. There are over 135 other species that depend on the salmon, and they are also integral to tribal culture. So when we talk about saving the salmon, we're really talking about so much more than that.
Actually, I want to interject something because I wanted to make mention that today is the federal celebration of Juneteenth, and that's a celebration of the liberation of the African-American slaves 170 years ago. But I'm thinking that this is also can be a celebration of the liberation of the salmon along the Snake and Columbia River, who've been impounded by dams for now almost 100 years. So I think so. Maybe we can think of this as our own Juneteenth for the salmon today.
Thank you, Barbara. Yeah, I think it's really important that we acknowledge this historic day as well, that we're gathered together. And I think there is a lot to talk about with this movement to remove the Lower Snake River dams. We last year had Representative Simpson from Idaho release a proposal. And I just want to acknowledge that that proposal was a really watershed moment for this movement. Anytime any elected member of United States Congress is raising the issue of Snake River dam removal, and in this case, notably a Republican from Idaho, this is a huge moment and it's never happened before. So as far as the plan, the proposal itself, It was super important progress. And although we don't agree with everything in that plan, and probably no one agrees with everything in the plan, the leadership and the initiating the conversation at that level was absolutely huge. We really look forward to that conversation continuing with Simpson being part of that leadership team. And the reality is that there's just a great deal of urgency right now surrounding how much time we have to save the salmon and steelhead from extinction. And in order to have our best shot at the largest salmon restoration in history, we're really going to need everyone on board. And that includes our elected officials on both sides, as well as the Biden and administration.
Well, I want to bring Kaylani into this conversation because your people have probably been on board first in trying to protect the salmon from these dams before the dams were even built. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the relationship that the Nez Perce have with the salmon and with these dams.
Thank you, Barbara, and I certainly appreciate you, Kate, for giving that acknowledgement. The Nez Perce Tribe has long fought to remove the four Lower Snake River dams. We knew from the beginning this was going to be detrimental to the salmon populations, and certainly there were promises made that that was not going to be the case. And of course, history has shown to not fully reflect that. We've certainly seen a huge decline in our salmon populations and other species. Right now, our big focus has been the salmon because that's been detrimental to so many other species, including the orca, which we've all unfortunately seen what's happened to those critical species, especially to our region. But there's other species involved in that, including the lamprey eel, which there's absolutely no passage that was created for them when the dams were constructed. And to this day, they still really can't get through. And then we also have the sturgeon. So there's so many other species that we are fighting for, but the salmon are the ones that they're on that brink. With the Nez Perce tribe, it's always been about the salmon. And even through the various different battles that we've had, the litigations we've brought forth, we know that breaching of the four Lower Snake River dams is certainly going to be detrimental to other aspects of work that we do. However, we're putting the salmon first and saying this needs to happen. If we don't have the salmon, we lose a piece of ourselves.
Why is it that breaching the dams might be detrimental to some of the other work that you're doing?
The Nez Perce tribe has several other enterprises and departments that we oversee. And so, you know, for example, we talk about the benefits that the dams provide, right? I think the Simpson proposal was a very comprehensive proposal that brought forward these different elements that would be impacted. And when we look at our enterprises, the amount of energy that's provided to run those enterprises, you know, even on that simple of a level, we recognize where we're going to have to adjust. But we're more than willing to do that. We know things can be differently. And while we have to face that challenge head on, we're ready to do it. And the Nez Perce tribe, I have been absolutely amazed about how they pretty much put their money where their mouth is and have gone full speed ahead in getting these initiatives, starting with Mimbuku Energy. The Nez Perce tribe is fully on board to put the funds in the place to start producing their own energy, to become self-sustainable in that manner, to be able to continue to run their enterprises. And that's just the start.
Well, I understand that the Snake River dams, that's why in my introduction I suggest that they don't really serve that much of a purpose. But my understanding is they don't provide a whole lot of energy, particularly compared to the other major dams on the Columbia River. And I know for a fact that there's not that much navigation that happens beyond the Tri-Cities area. Because one time I tried to get a tugboat ride from Bonneville Dam to Lewiston, Idaho, and I was told by Tidewater Barge that they only had a couple barges a week that went up that far. So I only went up as far as the Dalles. So there's not, besides the irrigation, which I understand is probably the most important service it provides, it seems like the other dams on the river provide a lot more services than those four Snake River dams.
And you're absolutely correct there, and that's where we're saying things can be done differently. And I think there's a big misunderstanding, too, as far as what green energy actually is and what these hydro systems actually provide, how much it's going to cost us to continue to maintain these hydro systems to produce that amount of energy that they currently are, knowing there are alternatives that will be able to do it in a more efficient and costly manner. And, you know, and I appreciate your comment about the barging. I had a conversation with a farmer, and his biggest concern is, he said, is just getting his product to market. When he spoke with the folks that transport the grain, he asked them, is it more expensive to transport by barge versus rail, or how do you choose? And what they told him, they said, you're going to pay the same cost regardless, whether we decide to do it by barge or by train. So in his mind, he said, if they decide to go ahead and breach the dams and they can't barge, but they can still do it by rail, he's fully in support of that so long as his products gets to the market.
Well, Kate, I wanted to talk a bit more about the details of Simpson's proposal. You said that you don't agree, or Columbia Riverkeeper doesn't agree, with the entire body of his proposals. But what makes it so promising? Why is this a real turnaround from the reactions of elected officials for the last 50 years as far as those dams go?
Thanks, Barbara. Yeah, so Representative Simpson's proposal was a critical step in the process that's since evolved to the point that we're at this moment in time with the Murray Inslee report being released. And we're really grateful for that leadership and continued and necessary participation and support for dam removal and replacement of services. But frankly, it is completely reset the discussion. Before the Simpson proposal, virtually no elected officials in the Pacific Northwest were talking about dam removal on this level. And now most of them are, from Murray and Inslee, Blumenauer, Brown, and others, to the Biden administration. Simpson played a big role in changing this conversation. And this certainly is the most exciting moment of this campaign in my lifetime. We, as you said in your intro, we really have some real momentum and cause for hope.
So what are some of the specifics of his proposal? And then let's talk more about Inslee and Murray's proposal.
Well, I'd actually love to jump into the Inslee-Murray proposal, since we really do see that Simpson proposal as a first step that's evolved us to this.
That was six months ago. It's like all of
right. Lots of things have happened. So I'd love to jump into the Murray-Inslee report that just was released. And we are really happy to see this report. It concludes some really important things, that removing the dams and replacing the services they provide is possible. We have the means to do it, and that removing the dams is urgent for salmon recovery and for tribal justice. So the draft report that was released on June 9th describes the services and the benefits currently provided by the dams, and the actions that have been taken, been considered to replace or improve upon the services, and then the benefits if the dams were to be breached. And the report also details things like the expected results of replacement actions, anticipated costs, and other questions that need to be answered still. I should clarify that the Murray-Inslee report is not a plan at this point. It's not making a recommendation one way or the other on dam removal. It's a report, essentially kind of a feasibility study, a report that's showing it's possible to replace the dams and that it is the best hope for Snake River salmon restoration. So the plan hopefully comes next. Senator Murray and Governor Inslee gave a deadline of July 31st of this year to release a plan that we expect will include lower Snake River dam removal and replacement of services.
So far, they're not taking a stand even yet about it's time to take the dams out.
The report does not give an explicit recommendation one way or the other, but it does illustrate that we have the means to do it, and it is the best hope we have for salmon recovery.
Now, I recall that Governor Brown here in Oregon actually came out for breaching the dams a couple years ago. Is that true?
Yeah, Governor Brown is someone who has expressed support for breaching the Lower Snake River dams, and we're really happy about that.
And she was the first elected official, I understand, from this region who actually took that stand.
Yeah, she was on board pretty early on, and it takes that kind of leadership. There, as I mentioned, I can't stress the urgency of this issue enough. We have a really critical time frame where extinction is a real threat on the horizon, and we need our elected officials to be taking bold action on this issue.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kate Murphy, Columbia Riverkeeper Community Organizer, and Kaylonie Scott, Communications Manager for the Nez Perce Tribe, about a new path forward to finally removing the four lower Snake River dams. Well, I want to talk a little bit about these services that are mentioned in the Murray-Inslee report and what they are and how they would be replaced. Do you want to start with that, Kaylonie?
Certainly. Thank you. We've been really hopeful with this report. We've certainly appreciated the several conversations that have gone on, the discussions that have been had to really make this a full report. And with it coming out, we're excited to see that it really does support investing in a new Northwest and what that could mean for everybody. We certainly appreciate that it shows that things can be done differently, and that breaching the four lower Snake River dams is not going to be to everyone's detriment. And I kind of, looking back at Simpson's proposal, we appreciated that he took all of these different facets into consideration and how they can still be made whole with making this bold decision. And so this report, we are hopeful that it will continue to do the same, and it's supporting that initiative that we've been a part of, you know, for the last 2 years, I suppose, at this point. I think some of those different elements in talking about transportation, agriculture, irrigation, I think it really points to the ways that we can do it differently and supports that we do have options. I think change is hard for anyone, but I feel like this report is going to show that we can do it.
So with as far as transportation goes, we talked a little bit about that. I mean, the barges, in my opinion, the barge system up to Lewiston, Idaho, has kind of been a joke. It's maybe it's a similar joke to the fact of the idea that the Port of Portland had for a long time that it would be an international port, being 100 miles inland. Well, Lewiston, Idaho, is, what, 300 miles inland. And so it seems that it really would not be that much of a difference doing away with the dams and the barging. But what would be the alternatives if there's no barging, even if it's only two barges a week that go up to Lewiston?
Certainly, we have alternatives and looking at not only trucking, but the rail system. And we've even talked to folks in Montana that are able to still get their products to market. You know, and I think where the Nez Perce tribe is located, of course, we're neighbors with the Lewis Clark Valley. And so they heavily rely on the systems in order to allow for their transportation. That's a big part of their industry, but also the tourism side of it. You know, we regularly hear about the different cruise boats that come through and what this would mean for them. But there's certainly those options, and there's ways that we can do it because it's already being done.
So, and you mentioned that it wouldn't cost any more for farmers to ship their wheat by train than it would by barge. I mean, I know when I took my ride up the river on Tidewater Barge about 20 years ago, they were touting how the barge was much greener than trucking because it didn't use as much fuel. And, of course, they didn't. I mean, I'm looking at all this kind of fossil fuel detritus getting spewed into the river as the guy was talking. But first of all, in terms of the climate, I mean, barging really isn't that great for the river or for the climate. Is that true?
Right, that's right.
But so
it's literally burning fish.
I mean, trains have their issues too, especially when they derail. But as if they're not carrying oil, it's not quite as bad. I guess carrying wheat is a whole lot safer. And then how about trucking? Because trucking does have a very large carbon footprint.
And I think it goes back to looking at ways that we can do it differently and looking at and navigating through these electric vehicles and even the various ways that we can use electric and the different forms of power through wind and solar, what have you. We can certainly look at those options for doing these different routes of transportation. And I know that there's folks looking into it and there's folks that are starting to do the research on how that can be done and even vehicles or modes of transportation that are currently testing those things out. And I think that's something that if we have the funding, we have the means to do it, it can certainly replace the barging system easily.
So, Kate, does the Biden administration's jumping on the bandwagon for this, is that going to provide federal funding at all to make these transitions?
I would hope so. I don't know the answer to that specifically. I do know that this will require Biden being on board, the Biden administration being on board. It requires an act of Congress, essentially. So it's a huge issue for this movement that the Biden administration has acknowledged it. We are hearing good things from the Biden administration, and they have committed to a durable path forward. They are taking leaderships from the tribe on this more seriously than before. And I think they understand that it's not just about saving salmon, it is about tribal justice as well as our ecosystem needing to be protected. And at the same time, we are still waiting for a concrete plan. You know, they're saying some of the right things, but we don't have a solid plan yet. But it is really important that they're on board. And we're at a point where the science is clear. The Lower Snake River dams block critical habitat. They make the water too hot. They only produce a small percentage of our region's electricity. These dams are no longer needed. They're extremely harmful. The damage that they do cause far outweighs the benefits. And there are viable alternatives for the services that they provide. And let's be clear that we're talking about evolving our infrastructure versus letting keystone species go extinct. So at this point, it seems to make all the sense in the world that we move forward with a plan to remove these dams.
Okay, Eleni, I want to talk about the tribal influence on this dam removal proposal that's moving forward now, but also the treaties that go way back that really give the tribes the right to have these fishing grounds and to not have them disrupted by the dam. So I want to talk a bit more about the role that salmon play in the tribal culture and survival. And what the tribes have been doing all along to try to take down these dams.
Certainly. I think it dates back to the beginning. And the tribes often talk about since time immemorial, meaning they can't even say how far back that goes. But in all of the stories and all of the history, when people were created and the creator came forward and told all of the creatures, we need to be able to provide for these people. And the salmon was the first one to come forward and say, I will give them myself to feed the people. In return, the people took on the role of caring for these species and speaking on their behalf, knowing they could no longer speak. And that's the story that we've held true to our hearts from the get-go. It's been really inspiring to see, even between the differences among tribes, it's been inspiring to see them all come together, knowing they're all fish people, and knowing that this is critical to not only our well-being, but our culture. And as history has shown, we've lost bits and pieces of our culture due to several different factors. But the salmon has always been a key component to everything we've done. Any ceremony or event you go to, you're going to find salmon. When the salmon first start coming in the spring, that's when we have our first food ceremony, and that's the first element to that process. We've had several years to where we didn't know if we were going to be able to have a fresh salmon for their first food ceremony. And fortunately, we have the technology to be able to store and freeze, and we have those options. However, it's supposed to be that first fresh salmon that comes through to be able to provide for the people and start the fishing season. Well, even just a couple of years ago, they really didn't know if they were going to be able to do it. And what it came down to is I believe they were able to get 2 or 3 fresh salmon, and then they had to supplement that. And that's just one example. I think the other side of it, too, that's really disheartening and scary is a lot of our songs and stories come from going to these places, including our fishing areas, including when the women are in the kitchen preparing. There's different techniques, there's different stories, there's different lessons that are taught within those moments. If they don't have those moments, those are going to be lost. And that's just a small visual of what we're facing if we were to lose our salmon completely.
Well, the fact that the Biden administration is talking about tribal sovereignty and tribal justice feels like we've come a really long way from when these dams were first put up. And I'm remembering a newsreel clip that I saw that was from when the backwater was being filled for the Dalles Dam. And there's pictures of the fishermen along Celilo Falls fishing for the last time. And the voiceover was, a disappearing fish for a disappearing people. And I think that was the attitude in 1957 when the Dalles Dam went up. And so I wonder how you see things have changed and if that attitude is still something that you're fighting.
It's true. It's a sad reality. You know, we're not naive to the fact that that was probably a mission for many. And we're proud to say that we're still here. I suppose I should say one group I've been extremely inspired by are the Umatilla Youth Council. And I think a lot of folks have gotten familiar, but these are just young teenage kids that are seeing the reality of what they're facing. And we're going to become reliant on this generation to keep pushing this forward for their future generations. But they've made that bold statement of saying our treaties are nothing if we don't have fish. We can't practice our treaty rights if there are no fish. So in looking at that, you know, we recognize what the past has held and probably what people were set out to accomplish. And going forward, I think people are realizing, obviously, the value that tribes placed in their communities. The Nez Perce tribe itself is one of the top 3 employers in our region. And through our economic studies, it's shown if without the tribes, even in just the state of Idaho, the state would go into a recession. You know, and that's just one component. It's not even looking at the work that we do to restore the waterways and to keep the salmon populations going and the other species. There's several other species. So I think looking at the tribes, several people are starting to realize, you know, the additional value that we bring and the expertise that we bring, because we've long been saying what needs to be done. And it's nice to see that people are finally recognizing that we know what we're talking about. You know, even with some of our staff or some of our employees or just tribal members in general, maybe not even having a degree in a certain field, there's cultural traditional practices that we've been doing, you know, for centuries, and that's been able to maintain this landscape that we've been living on.
Well, one of the things that seemed to really point a lot of fingers at the Snake River dams was the movement to save the orca and the Salish Sea and the southern resident orca, who are going extinct painfully and very visibly to people who live along the shores of the Salish Sea. And when the connection was made between the need for the orcas to be able to feed on salmon and that their salmon population was being decimated by those dams in particular, it seemed like it put a very bright light once again on the Snake River dams. I'm wondering, Kate, how you see that might have really helped to change the picture a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the southern resident orca are such an iconic species for this region, and people do love them and identify with them as sentient creatures who share this space with us. And we've seen great displays from these orcas of grief upon losing their calves, and of, you know, things that we really relate to as humans. And they've been some of the best advocates for restoring this free-flowing river. You know, people talk a lot about the cost of doing these things. And, you know, as Kehlani mentioned, we cannot put a cost on what it is to tribal cultures to lose these different species. But, you know, as with any complex restoration effort, there is a price tag attached to it. And I just think regardless, it will be a significant investment. But I'd be happy to unpack that a little bit to put that cost into context.
Yeah, go ahead, do that.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing I think we should all be able to agree on is that the salmon restoration efforts in the past several decades have not been particularly effective. We've spent, you know, $17 billion or more on salmon recovery that hasn't worked. And given that so many attempts have been ineffective, we really should be investing in doing the thing that science suggests is our best chance at Snake River salmon and steelhead recovery. And we need to keep in mind that this is not as if we're throwing this money away. We can't think of it as pouring money down the drain, right? This is money that's going to be invested in the Pacific Northwest. That money is going to fund jobs for people who are upgrading transmission lines, installing new clean renewable energy projects, upgrading irrigation systems, upgrading the infrastructure in our transportation system, which is in need of an upgrade anyway. And, you know, we have an opportunity here to do something that makes the Pacific Northwest a better place, honors tribal rights, and sets an example for restoration efforts around the world. And removing those dams is not unprecedented. We have seen dam removal result in successful restoration of fish populations in other rivers, and it's a proven way to restore a river. So the cost of dam removal is not a loss. It is an investment in the Pacific Northwest, and it's worth it.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Saddle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kate Murphy, Columbia Riverkeeper Community Organizer, and Kehlani Scott, Communications Manager for the Nez Perce Tribe, about a new path toward finally removing the four lower Snake River dams. I know there's been a lot of dam removal projects over the last few years, and there's been a couple notable ones here in the Northwest. The most recent one was removing the dam on the White Salmon River, now I guess about 10 years ago. However, the four dams on the Snake River are quite a bit bigger than any of the dams or rivers that I know have had dams breached and removed. So I wonder what that plays in this whole equation of the actual logistics of removing them and then the logistics of replacing their services.
Yeah, even in a best case scenario, we're not expecting dam removal to start immediately when the plan is released. We do understand this is a process that requires planning and preparation, and takes some time. Again, we have to recognize the urgency of this issue. Extinction is a real threat that we're facing, and we are hopeful that the implementation of any timeline that's proposed will meet the urgency of the issue. So, you know, the research shows the dams can and should come out. It is a complex process. That cannot be an excuse for taking decades to make it happen. We do agree these things need to be planned out and have some sequence to them, but we don't have much time. And Kehlani can speak to this better than I can about the harms that have already come from these dams. So the combination of urgency and opportunity to invest in this region brings us to a critical moment for taking real action. And so, you know, as we discussed, we have the capacity to make these replacements of services. And it's a matter of, do we have the will to do it? And I just want to clarify, too, we talk about dam removal, and sometimes we talk about breaching the dams. And I just want to explain that when we talk about breaching the dams, we talk about removing the earthen part in the middle of the dam. So it, some dams, you know, essentially get totally removed. And when we talk about breaching the dams, these dams were constructed with an earthen part in the center that is designed to be able to be removed and restore the free-flowing river.
Now, do all the dams along the Columbia have earthen parts, or is it just the Snake River dams that have them?
I believe it's the Snake River dams.
Because I'm trying to imagine, I mean, I'm very familiar with the Bonneville and the Dalles Dam, and I don't remember seeing anything earthen there.
Yeah, the Columbia River dams are kind of a bigger...
be a big deal to take them out.
Yeah.
So people are fantasizing about that now, too.
Yeah, and all of the main stem dams create hardships for the fish and are problematic, but we do recognize that it's much more feasible at this moment to remove those lower Snake River dams and replace those services that they're providing.
One of the things that has been argued in the past about removing the Snake River dams or breaching them was that there's all the sediment that builds up behind the dams, and that once you take the that center part of the dam out, that sediment's just going to go wild. So, Kehlani, how serious is that concern, and what can be done to mitigate that?
Certainly, that is one of the issues that has to be addressed as we move forward with creating this plan. And as Kate mentioned, with breaching, it is simply removing these earthen portions so the water can continue to flow freely. And knowing that there's sedimentation buildup there has been for a while, it's already causing an issue. There's sedimentation buildup that's already causing issues to those waterways and making them unsafe. You know, even as we have folks going out there to fish and harvest, they're facing dangers on that river. So it's one of those processes. We've got to be able to put the funding toward that as we move forward with creating our plan so we can continue with the breaching.
So what would the river look like without those dams?
I think, you know, I'm 32, and so I certainly wasn't here before the dams were put in place, but I have been able to see photos. I've been able to meet some, and that's one thing that's been really neat about this journey is connecting with all of these folks that are just passionate about the same thing. And so I met some folks, strangely enough, in Lewiston. It's a small group, but they are huge advocates for dam breaching. And they have these photos of at least the LC Valley and the pristine waters and beautiful beaches that were prevalent when there weren't dams. And I think that's really intriguing to see not only that and the recreation that allows for the communities, but also the natural vegetation, you know, the natural creatures. We have several creatures that are no longer in our region because they don't have the means to feed themselves. So I think there's several components that would really come back and flourish in a more natural environment that we aren't seeing right now. Our waterways are pretty much lined with rock, you know, and then whatever that takes in order to allow for the barging. And so I think I would be really excited to see that process.
Well, one of the things that really struck me the first time I went to Lewiston, Idaho, was that there's this massive wall, basically. It's kind of like the Berlin Wall between the city and the river. And as far as I can tell, there's no access to the river from most or any part of Lewiston. It's really important that all of us who live along the Columbia River have access to this river and connection to its magnificence. So what would it be like, do you think, to regain that access?
I think, just as an individual, I think it would be phenomenal. I mean, and you make a great point, because I just, in thinking about in the city of Lewiston, Clarkston, you have maybe a couple access points to waterfront. You know, and it's usually not nice waterfront. We certainly have our fair share of ducks and geese that also enjoy those waterfronts, and they kind of take over. And so it's really limited, I think. And when you talk about this wall, it is. It's all rock that's been built up to support support these waterways. And so folks can gaze at the waterways from a sidewalk, but there's really no access unless you have a boat or unless you're, you know, getting out in your kayaks or what have you. But you're not going to be able to kind of have that nice front to just sit and enjoy, you know, your feet in the water or anything like that.
Well, it seems like Lewiston and Clarkson will have to do a bit of rethinking about their identities as communities, because at least for the last 50 or so years, they have basically seen themselves as being the furthest inland seaports in the world. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not such a great identity, but I'm wondering if there's a movement afoot in Idaho and in eastern Washington to rethink the significance and the importance of what these communities could be if the dams were breached.
I agree. I think with anything, a lot of, I mean, even before the dams, right, there was a huge, we were known for canning of fish, you know, and obviously that's gone by the wayside, but things of all times change and you adapt to those changes. And it's just like anything else, as hydro systems don't really have a place anymore. They're outdated. There's been several folks that said if they proposed to put the dams in today, it would have never happened. I think for the Valley, and I know there's a lot of people that are forward thinkers and recognizing the opportunities becoming available, but we have new options. We have options to actually grow our communities here in the Lewis-Clark Valley, and options that we hadn't had before. We hadn't thought we were able to accommodate, but we can do that. I think it's taking the opportunity to change and looking at what options are available. We have here in the Valley great resources and great availability to be able to do those sorts of things. And I just think it's willing to take the community to come together and say we can do it, and how are we going to do it?
Well, you mentioned early in the show, Kaolani, that there was opposition to these dams even before they were built. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the movements among the tribes. I'm not sure there was that much opposition outside of the tribal communities to stop the dams. And I know, I mean, there's one dam that was built after I moved to Portland 50 years ago. The rest of them, I think, had already been in place and were built in the 60s. I remember when that last dam was built. I don't remember opposition to it, though. So I wanted to get a sense from your picture what you've heard from the people that you live with.
Certainly, there was a lot of confusion on what these hydro systems would mean. And of course, the biggest concern for tribal members were what it would do to the fish. And back in those times, the fish was ridiculously prevalent. There were no concerns or issues about there never being fish. I don't think anyone predicted we'd be here today facing what we're facing. But we knew that this would have an impact. And while we continued to be told it wouldn't be an issue, there would be devices created so salmon continue to pass and those sort of things. Unfortunately, fairly quickly, mind you, it hasn't been that long, we've seen the detriment. And that's just one component. The other thing that we recognized was putting these hydro systems in place, we would lose several of our villages, several of our cultural sites, several of our sites where we would go to practice certain traditions. And that's still the case as those reservoirs built up, tribal members watched as burial grounds were covered, as villages were covered, as fishing sites were covered. And there aren't many people that can speak to that today, but those stories have been hounded down. And I remember hearing a story. It's from somebody, one of my elders now, and I think it was their dad that told them that, you know, no, don't go watch it. You don't want to see this. And so I think that's an impact that isn't spoken of or isn't as widely known, to what people felt when that happened. You know, and we still have people that know and recognize the different cultural components that are under those waters. But that was one thing that we just didn't have a voice to be able to save those items. And now looking forward and what this would mean to breach those dams and have those water levels go back to their natural state or as close to it, on what that would mean. Some of these sites to where we can continue to tell those stories or regain those stories or continue to care for our people the way that they should be cared for, I think is huge. And there is a process that's going to have to take place, you know, once that does happen, but we're prepared to deal with that. And we know that that is the reality, but it was also a situation that we never asked for.
I think a lot of people in Portland now are familiar with the story of Salado Falls. And there's, again, the same story where some of the tribal people stood on the cliffs and watched the backwaters fill and bury everything that they valued. And other people couldn't bear it. It was just too painful. But I think what people in Portland don't realize is that same story repeats itself for every dam that was built on the Columbia. And now I think we're finally starting to hear the impact those Snake River dams have had. But the other thing that's kind of ironic to me is that we are very dependent on the services of the main stem Columbia River dams. But it seems, as you've said and other people have said, that the services provided by the Snake River dams are relatively negligible, and we can find ways to replace them. So they're removing the Snake River dams has been called the low-hanging fruit of salmon survival. I wonder if that's something that you see and if that's another way of really reinforcing the need to take them out.
I certainly agree with that. I think this is, and I think Kate spoke to it too, this is a viable option. It is low-hanging fruit, and it's also just the first step. There are so many other factors that need to be taken in consideration and fought for in order to make it happen. In order to have these species flourish, this is the first step to enable that process to begin. Because it's, again, and as I mentioned earlier, it's not just about the salmon. There are several species impacted, not just our water species either. So it's the first step. It's something that's completely feasible, and it will allow us to continue our process to recover this critical species.
I'm thinking as we talk about removing the Snake River dams, maybe if they are taken out, then we can start thinking about taking out the John Day Dam, and maybe the McNary Dam, because those are the two other dams that are really seriously impeding the salmon, even more so than the Dalles and the Bonneville. But you're listening to Locus Focus on Cambria Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Kate Murphy, Columbia Riverkeeper Community Organizer, and Kaoloni Scott, Communications Manager for the Nez Perce Tribe, about a new path toward finally removing the four lower Snake River dams. Okay, what can the public do? Because it sounds like this is still a plan. It's not even a proposal yet. And there still could be a whole lot of ways that it could be torpedoed. And one of the things that makes me very nervous is realizing when I think Kaoloni said that this has to be approved by a congressional decision, and Congress is a pretty scary place right now. So what can the public do to weigh in to make sure that this plan turns into a proposal which turns into action?
Yeah, this is a really critical moment. Right now we are in a public comment period until July 11th at 5 p.m. So we are encouraging everyone to participate in this important public comment period. And those comments can be submitted at www.lsrdoptions.org. That's lsrdoptions.org. And we're really hoping that people will participate in this comment period. Right now is such a critical movement, and what we really need is to push and put pressure on our elected officials. If you have an elected official, call them, tell them you want Snake River Dam removal. And this is a critical moment. Public pressure for Snake River Dam removal is probably the number one thing we can ask people to do right now to really make sure that our elected officials are hearing a huge outpouring of public support for dam removal. And that only really happens when folks get involved. And I just have to reiterate that this country made a promise to the tribes that they would be able to continue to catch fish in perpetuity. And that's just not a promise that we have kept. The fact that it now requires an investment for us to keep our promises, that just is a consequence of our decisions. And we really feel that, the bottom line is that dam removal makes sense for so many reasons, including economic standpoint. And this is a huge opportunity. If we decide to come together and seize it, it's an opportunity to solve problems, to meet needs, to honor tribes, and to make investments in the infrastructure we need to for the future of this region. So the comment period is really important. We have until July 11th, and then we also have an exciting event coming up.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. So this is an open invite to the public. This is the Rally for Salmon, which we're really excited about. There's, you know, I'm working closely with our partners at Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition and you know, so many other organizations, nearly probably over 30 organizations are partnered on this event at this point. So the Rally for Salmon is on June 25th. That's this coming Saturday. It's going to be at Willamette Park from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The weather's looking great at the moment. So Willamette Park is just off of McAdam, just here in Portland. And this event is really for us to show up and stand in solidarity with tribal leadership to save the salmon and orcas and other species from extinction. It's going to be so much fun. It's you know, kind of like a festival taking shape. So we're going to have a big water flotilla, which a lot of folks are really excited about. We're going to have everything from, you know, kayakers, paddleboarders, canoes, whitewater rafts, and sports fishing boats in this flotilla. It's going to be a beautiful event visually. We're going to have lots of things happening on land as well. We've invited a number of really exciting speakers, regional leaders, and extended that invitation to a number of folks who were really excited about joining. And it's just going to be such a fun time. There's going to be music, live music, and food, and booths for folks to engage. And so we really encourage folks to come out, show support. There will be opportunities to, you know, make comments and reach out to your electeds on site. And we really expect it to be a big celebration of this progress we're making in the movement to save these species from extinction.
So Willamette Park is a rather big place. So where in the park is it going to be?
Thanks. Yeah, that's right. So as you enter the park off of McAdam, I think it's on Nebraska, 6500 McAdam is the address, I believe. And so you just kind of travel down into the park and you go towards the boat ramp. That's going to be the easiest way to look for it. And there's a big parking lot. And then just south of that is a big green space. We're going to be utilizing the boat ramp on the east side of the parking lot. And then as well as the green spaces where we'll have our stage set up, there's going to be a bright yellow fire truck parked there with big banners on top. So that's a great landmark for folks to look for as well.
So one concern I have, I was just down at Willamette Park yesterday, and part of the park is underwater. It's the part that's below the embankment, but the river is really, really high, and yesterday it was not raining, and there's still nobody was boating. So I'm just wondering, if the river is still that high next Saturday, what are your plans?
Yeah, thanks for raising that, Barbara. Safety is our number one priority for any time we have people on the water. So we have an amazing crew working on the water piece of this event. We've got folks from Mosquito Fleet who will be there and Backbone Campaign, as well as the sports fishing folks helping with safety planning. We also have a contingency plan. If the water levels are not looking safe a day or two out, we're going to do a scouting paddle, and we will make a call, and we'll use our other plan if we need to keep people safe. But either way, it will be a fun and exciting way to get involved.
So again, what time is that? And
that's from 10 o'clock to 3 p.m., 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We're asking folks participating in the flotilla to arrive starting at 9. And we are encouraging everyone. We're trying to do a low-waste event. There will be food on site, but we're encouraging folks to bring their water bottles to refill, try to be mindful of limiting waste and things like that.
And just to let people know, the easiest way to get to Willamette Park, there's a big sign, or moderately big sign, when you're heading north on McAdam, and also I think probably when you're heading south on McAdam, and you're right, it's Nebraska Street, and you take you go east on Nebraska Street,
yeah, towards the
direction,
river.
Towards the river, and then when you get down, you cross the railroad tracks, and you're going to head to the right, and the parking lot for the boat ramp is on the right.
That's right.
and be interesting. I mean, it's supposed to be a beautiful day on Saturday, so
bring your sunscreen.
Definitely that. And I think it's supposed to actually be 80 something.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, our own little heat wave.
keep it there, not any hotter.
Yeah. So it'll be like a wonderful way to enjoy the end of the rain, as we hope, in the beginning of summer.
Certainly.
Well, one last thing I wanted to talk about. I wanted to have both of you envision what it would be like once these dams are removed, which it sounds like it's not going to be for years. Even the plan isn't even going to be put forth until another month from now. So once this is all happening, how do you envision how it's going to transform all of our lives here in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, and I'd love to hear from Kehlani on this, but for me personally, when I think about it, you know, it's really exciting to think about that moment of being able to actually see this section of river restored to a free-flowing river with my own eyes. But what really, you know, kind of gives me goosebumps is thinking about, you know, my nieces and future generations who will have the benefit of not only having access to these majestic rivers, but hopefully getting that experience to see the salmon runs and be a part of that. So for me, this is, and for so many of us, I mean, this is a really a long-term wish with that could have immediate short-term benefits for us as well. But the long-term impacts of this are so significant that that's what really gets my blood kind of pumping when I think about it.
And how about you, Kehlani?
I believe on the simplest scale of what I'm most excited for is for our tribal members to be able to continue to provide for our elders and those without means on a larger basis. We've gone so many years to where part of our culture is we provide for those that are in mourning because they are not able to, as part of the tradition, they're not able to hunt, fish, or gather for a year after they've lost someone. We've been at a point to where we don't have the resources to provide for them. And so oftentimes they go without any salmon. And that's not how it was historically. Historically, tribal members caught extra fish so that they could provide for those folks, they could provide for the elders. And what I look forward to is being able to see that again, being able to see, get to a healthier state, knowing that they can survive off of these salmon species that have long provided the nutrition that we value. And just with that and continuing to be able to provide the stories and the history of these various locations that are so important to us, those are the moments that are keystone in this fight as the tribe moves forwards to restore these salmon populations.
Okay, Kehlani and Kate, it's wonderful talking to you. I look forward to seeing. I know I'll see you, Kate, on Saturday. Yeah. Kehlani, are you going to come into Portland as well?
I sure hope so. I really want to be there.
Okay, well, I really want to meet you, so hopefully you'll be there. So thank you for being on Locust Focus, and let's all struggle together to save the salmon.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Kate Murphy, Columbia Riverkeeper Community Organizer, and Kehlani Scott, Communications Manager for the Nez Perce Tribe. And you've been listening to Locust Focus on KWU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, Eric DePlace with the Ohio River Valley Institute will give a mini course on Hydrogen 101. We'll go out with music by Wayne Shorter and Milton Nascimento. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary. Eu vejo essa espécie se for de coração. Eu vejo essa...
essas matas e vou de coração à natureza. Falam colorido de crianças coloridas, de um gênio televisor. E no andor de nossos novos santos, o sinal de velhos tempos: morte, morte, morte ao amor. Eles não falam do mar e dos peixes, nem deixam ver a moça pura canção, nem ver nascer a flor, nem ver nascer. Eu apenas sou um a mais a falar dessa dor, a nossa dor. Desenhando nessas pedras, tem em mim todas as cores, quando falo coisas reais. E no silêncio dessa natureza, eu que amo meus amigos, livre quero poder dizer: tenho esses peixes e dó de coração.